This is the Current Federal Tax Developments, brought to you by the Lascauzo Institute for the week of May the 29th, 2017. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by both the Lascauzo Institute and your state society of CPAs. This week, it's been kind of a quiet week here on tax developments. Partially, it's because the holiday weekend was coming up. Not a whole lot of things have happened. We've had a few cases, so it's a little bit quiet this week, but we'll talk about some of our developments, including a reconstruction of income case we have coming up here, a look at why an organization failed to qualify as a 501c3 organization. We'll talk some about the special rules for charitable contributions for a Form 1041. We'll take a look at a state that had to apply for private letter ruling to make an election late to deal with that, and we'll talk about the nature of that election that you might want to make, maybe not late, but you might want to make on time. And we also had the tax court dealing with a case with a deathbed transfer, and that deathbed transfer estate planning just didn't work out too well for everybody. We'll talk about what went wrong in that case and why the deathbed planning didn't end up getting the results the taxpayers would have liked. Well, still got more courses coming up as normal, and I want to bring up, I'm doing a few courses in New Jersey coming up toward the end of June, and you might want to take a look at getting those up and running now. So if you're in the New Jersey area and you're looking at doing courses, I have one course coming up in Voorhees, New Jersey, in the mansion on Main Street. That course I will do on June the 20th. That is going to be a discussion of the income taxation of estates and trusts. That course will look at the complications of just the Form 1041. That's what we're looking at. We'll also take a look, though, specifically at, because you have to know it in order to do a Form 1041, the New Jersey Uniform Principal and Income Act. So we'll have a discussion about how that works, what we mean by this weird concept of accounting income, and how accounting income is tied into the New Jersey Uniform Principal and Income Act. On that same day, in Iceland, New Jersey, at the APA Hotel Woodbridge, because I'm not going to be at two places at once, we're going to have a series of courses there, but the first one will be taught by Ken Heeslip, who's going to be teaching the ANA course down there on the 20th, and that'll be Understanding and Testing Internal Control. So he'll be down there in Iceland on the 20th. I will ride the Amtrak train down that night, and so on the 21st, I will be doing a session. I'll begin my first of three sessions there at the Hotel Woodbridge. On the 21st, we'll talk about financial and estate planning for those over age 55. That particular course will take a look at a number of planning issues that we have to worry about these days. We'll also take a look at, on top of all of that, some of the issues that we're going to deal with Social Security, issues we may want to talk about, including portability issues and some planning in that area. We'll take a look on the 22nd. I'll give you a full-day course on fringe benefits. This is from an employer standpoint. And we'll talk about, you know, this various compensation issues related to fringe benefits. Obviously, one of our discussion points is going to have to be the current status of the healthcare benefits for employers. And as you may know, this is a little bit up in the air at the moment. But we'll talk about both the requirements under the laws that currently exist, which is the Affordable Care Act. We'll also maybe get into a brief discussion, depending upon how things have developed in the Senate by then, of what potentially might come up under whatever the Senate passes and the House finally agrees to if we get changes. So we'll take a look at what goes on there. We'll also talk about all the other types of fringe benefits, qualified retirement plans. We'll talk about the issues related to various types of specialized group, because we often get so tied up with the healthcare and the qualified retirement plans that we forget there's a whole bunch of other fringe benefits that we need to know how to deal with when we're dealing with employees. And then finally, on the 23rd, I'll do a course, the Assisting the Survivors of the Decedent's Estate, at the Hotel Woodbridge in Iceland. That course is going to deal with estates. It's somewhat related to the course I did in Voorhees, except we're not going to concentrate solely on the issue of preparing a 1041. In fact, that'll be a relatively minor portion of the course. We will still talk about the New Jersey Uniform Principal and Income Act, because quite often we are going to be forming trusts, and one of our deals of dealing with that estate is going to be handling the proper setup and accounting for principal and income on trusts that are established by the estate. We'll talk about retirement plans, and that's often one of the major assets we have to deal with that's coming through an estate. How do we deal with those retirement plans that are now being inherited and passing to the second generation, or maybe passing to a surviving spouse? We'll talk about the amazing and shortly to be disappearing one-year special new New Jersey estate tax. We'll talk about the old New Jersey estate tax that was in place for those that died in 16. We'll talk about the 2017 one-year special New Jersey estate tax. And then we'll talk about that going away in 2018. But we'll also talk about the New Jersey inheritance tax, which is not going anywhere. We'll talk about how all that impacts working with survivors of the decedent's estates. For any of those courses, go online at the New Jersey Society of CPAs website. We have those, and we have a bunch of other courses put on for the New Jersey Society, both from those of us on the tax side and from the ANA side, and actually a whole bunch more in June, a number earlier than that. So go ahead, check there. If you're in New Jersey, take a look and take a look at those courses. Well, let's get started now with our main tax aspect of today, and it's an anniversary date. I bet you all were celebrating on Friday the 26th because it's a big anniversary date. Wikipedia has a page about this. This is how big a tax development it is. And Wikipedia doesn't have pages on many tax issues, but it has a page on this. Now, some of you, I can't believe it, but some of you may not know what the 25th anniversary issue is. 25 years ago, on May the 26th of 1992, the U.S. Supreme Court issued its opinion in the case of Quill versus North Dakota. 504 U.S. 298 was issued by that, the majority opinion authored by Justice Stevens for the court. We had dissents, we had concurrences, we had all kinds of neat things in this opinion. This is the case that talks about when the state of North Dakota was trying to impose a requirement for Quill, the office supply company, to collect use tax from its customers in the state of North Dakota. And this established what's been our nexus for sales and use tax collection, and we've been working around this for now. Under this rule, in order to require a vendor to collect sales or use tax from your citizens of your state, the state had to show that they had substantial nexus. Substantial nexus generally in the Quill case is presumed to require some sort of physical presence in the state. The opinion itself did indicate that things were changing and that maybe this standard wasn't appropriate or wouldn't be much longer. Now, we said that 25 years ago, and since then, we've not had another case come up and really challenge this issue. Now, however, we now have seen states are getting much more aggressive in this area. In fact, a lot of observers believe we are not going to be celebrating the 50th anniversary of Quill, with Quill still being the law of the land. A number of states have added economic nexus tests. What that generally looks at is how much in terms of total sales were made into the state by a company operating outside the state, and regardless of your other contacts with the state, if you sell more than a certain figure, normally somewhere in the six-figure range, to customers in that state, then the state asserts you have to collect and pay over the use or sales tax. We've also seen states, South Dakota probably being the best known, that have adopted statutes that just blatantly ignore Quill. And they're doing that to try to force another hearing on the case because there's been a lot of speculation. The case itself invited speculation that this shouldn't stand as law forever. And a lot of people think that, you know, the Supreme Court should rehear this case, and if they do, may change the rules. But for now, you can celebrate, unless you're a state revenue department with a state with sales tax, you can celebrate the Quill case 25 years and well, maybe not going strong anymore, but certainly continuing. So it was our anniversary week for the Quill case, 25 years. Let's take our first federal case. Now we're going to take the case here of Common versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2017-35. This particular case takes a look at reconstruction of income issues. In the Common case, we had a taxpayer whose tax return was pulled for examination. And the IRS agent that was looking at the return wanted to do a deposit analysis for the bank account. Now, the problem she had was she requested the bank account information from the taxpayers. The taxpayers didn't give it to her. Eventually, she had to issue summonses to the banks she knew about that, you know, she was aware there were accounts there. And she did her deposit analysis. Now, but at the end of the day, when she did her deposits analysis, she came up with $169,603.04 worth of deposits that were not obviously things like transfers or obviously non-taxable income. The Schedule C that the taxpayers reported for their business income that year only showed total revenue of $128,070. As well, the taxpayers had received two Form 1099-Ks that essentially totaled $151,835.06, which was A, more than was on the Schedule C, and B, was also $17,000 more than the deposits that were listed in the bank statement she had that indicated that they were, you know, coming from credit card transfers. So the agent concluded that A, of course, they hadn't reported as much income as they should, but B, in fact, there's got to be another bank account somewhere that was receiving these transfers. And while we don't know what it is, what she decided was she took her $169,603.04, but then she took out from that the deposits that she could prove were bank, that, you know, that clearly per the statement were bank card deposits. And she added back what was shown on the 1099-Ks. So now she's got for total deposits, you know, for total income, somewhere just over $180,000 of income, as opposed to the 128 that was shown on the tax return for the taxpayer. Now, the taxpayer, of course, claims that no, this isn't right. Now, the taxpayer had a litany of reasons why items that she said the deposits that she was going to treat as income, because under, you know, when the IRS looks to reconstruct income from a deposits analysis, they are allowed to assume that everything is income unless it's obvious that it's a transfer of some sort, so there's evidence that's true, or the taxpayer can show, you know, proof, evidence of a source of the deposit that did not come from income. Well, the taxpayer had a lot of reasons why the numbers were larger than what was on his return. One of the first claims he had was that he had a large cash hoard, apparently cash stuffed in the mattress somewhere, and that the cash hoard should actually accounted for the cash deposits that she found during the year. Okay. He also claimed that there were checks that were deposited. And those checks, he said, really, even though they were made out to his business, they weren't his because his brother operated a business with the same name, and he deposited those checks into his account for his brother and then would allow his brother to take the funds out using an ATM card. He then also said the unaccounted credit card charges, those were also really his brother's income. He allowed his brother to use his machine for business. Now, the big problem with all of this was, aside from his statements, he offered no proof for this. Now, the court specifically indicated that they were always very, very suspicious, noted a lot of people claim this cash hoard theory to explain why they have more deposits in the bank than were shown as being shown as income. And as the court noted, very rarely does the cash hoard theory work. In this case, it didn't. Normally, the real problem we usually have with the cash hoard. Now, he claimed he got this cash hoard from inheritances, but again, he didn't provide any proof of that inheritance of cash, real green stuff. The other problem is if you're really keeping stuff out of the bank because you don't trust the bank, whatever reason you've got in the mattress, why'd you suddenly start putting it in there this year? That's the other problem we have to kind of understand. Now, he claims they'd put money in when they didn't have enough money to pay bills. Okay, maybe, but it still seems kind of unusual. And secondly, he offered no actual proof of the cash hoard. What about those check deposits for his brother's name and the fact his brother was really the party that should have reported those that income from the credit cards? Well, the problem there is while he brought in a letter that he said was from his brother that, you know, backed up his story, he didn't actually bring his brother into court, nor did he make his brother available to the IRS agent. The court said, well, the letter is inadmissible hearsay. They said, you know, if you really want to use that, we need to bring the brother in here and have the brother say it, you know, on the record in court, which the brother wasn't doing. So the tax court effectively justified this. But what about the fact that the agent took a 1099-K number instead of the actual deposits? Now, we've discussed before on this podcast Section 6201D of the Internal Revenue Code. That section says, effectively, that if a taxpayer cooperates with the IRS, right, fully cooperates with the service and exam, and raises a reasonable question about the veracity of a information reporting form, or just says, I can't prove the number, then the IRS has to come up with additional evidence to back it up. In this case, the court said, taxpayer, remember that bit that they couldn't get the bank statements from the taxpayer and they didn't make the brother available? The court said the taxpayer, because they had not made the brother available to confirm that statement about why they had more 1099 income, and they had not offered up the bank statements up front to allow the agent to confirm things and tie things together, the taxpayer had given up the protection of 6201D. So the IRS, if it wanted to, can simply rely on that information return. Now, it turns out the IRS had other information as well, which meant they wouldn't really have had to, but present a problem for the taxpayer. So again, taxpayer losing their benefits there. Next up, we're going to take a look at an attempt for an exempt org to qualify. This is Private Letter Ruling 2017-20-010, issued on May the 19th. Now, this was an organization that wanted to go into, it was trying to form as an exempt organization, actually started, then redid things because things changed. It was initially going to develop software to support open source software to support community journalism organizations, but then that software got developed by another open source project. So it morphed into a program that was going to be supporting these community news organizations. And it looked to gain 501c3 status. It was going to provide training and administrative support services to these community news organizations. It pointed out that, you know, with changes happening these days, that community news was being neglected because we were going to more national news. The commercial services were going very national. We were kind of losing local and especially community news services. And we were also, some people who had access to it didn't have access on the web. So we had other reasons that we needed to have these community services in place. Now, this would then, what they were going to do was have these community services be affiliates of the group. They would give them mentorship, training on best practices, and administrative and program support for things like bookkeeping, tracking memberships, information technology, et cetera, to take the burden off those organizations from having to perform those services for themselves so they could go out and do news. Well, all sounds well and good, except, as the IRS concluded, that's not really the exempt purpose. You're not really providing community news or doing those sorts of things. Rather, they said, even though you said you're going to price it at a level, because they're going to charge these groups for this, but they're going to price it at a level that would be below the level necessary to maintain profitable operations, they said what you're really doing is providing administrative support services to a news organization. And that's something which commercial entities would do. That's something that's a commercial structure. You're not actually part of providing the news. Now, the court went, the IRS concluded that you are much more like the organization Revenue Ruling 72369 that provided management and consulting services at cost for related for exempt organization. The revenue ruling held that did not work. They said you're not like the taxpayer in the case of Forest Press Inc. versus Commissioner, 22 TC 265, a 1954 tax court case. That was an organization devoted to developing and propagating the use of Dewey Decimal Classification System and Related Index. That organization qualified as charitable, but in that case, it was because that was a unique and important assistance to education and research, and it was not a commercial enterprise. It wasn't like there were 16 other entities selling, you know, these classification systems that a library could use. This was going to be a standardized, centralized kind of program that was different. So the organization was not engaged in exempt activity. Rather, it's an activity that competed with commercial enterprises. It's not enough just not to make a profit or not be in it to make money. You have to actually, to be a 501c3, you've got to meet one of the requirements for the exemptions. You have your activity has to be one of those specifically defined in 501c3 as being the type of activity that will qualify for this type of organizations. And merely selling services for no profit to organizations that are doing that won't get you there. Next up, we're going to talk about the special issues related to charitable contributions of trusts and estates on Form 1041. This is private letter ruling 2017-20003, issued on May the 19th. Now, when we get to charitable contributions on a 1041, they're subject to a lot of unusual rules. This is covered in more detail in our write-up for the case. It's governed by Section 642 of the Code. Generally, a deduction can be claimed for a charitable contribution on Form 1041 is claimed on Schedule A of Form 1041, which has nothing to do with Schedule A of Form 1040, but you only claim it under the following conditions. The charitable contribution must be made from gross income, and that's a tax term as defined in Section 61. Do not confuse that with income under the Uniform Principal and Income Act or the trust document. This is gross income, a Section 61 term. And the amount must be paid pursuant to the governing instrument. That could be the trust or the will, depending upon if you've got an estate, trust, whatever, but a governing document. If those two conditions are met, what's unique is, first you have to meet those conditions. That's something an individual or corporation doesn't have to meet. But if we meet them, there's no percentage limitation on how much of a deduction can be claimed. The deduction is available without limit. Also unique about a trust or estate on a 1041, they actually have a choice of which year to claim a deduction in, or unusual rules. So for most deductions, the trust or estate can claim the deduction either in the year in which a contribution is actually paid in cash or in the year prior to the year in which the deduction is made or is actually paid. That's an election under 642C1. Now, you may remember from earlier cases we discussed last year, or actually at this point, 2 years ago, if you have an estate or you've got a really old trust, you can also claim a deduction if amounts are permanently set aside by the trust or estate for charitable purposes in the year in which they are permanently set aside. Now, as I said, most trusts these days, you don't have very many pre-1969 trusts out there. Most trusts these days aren't going to qualify for this, but an estate can't permanent set aside. We had a long discussion of that 2 years ago. I've got cross references in the materials. If you download them, you can go read the articles there. That's a very difficult standard to meet. Just be aware of that. Most times you're going to be looking at the first two standards. You've either got this year or the prior year, right? We get to that. Now, to do that, though, you have to make your election by filing an income tax return or amended return for the taxpayer where the contribution is treated as paid, with a statement that says name and address of fiduciary, the estate or trust for which it's acting. You're making the election under 642C1, the name and address of the organizations, and the amount of each contribution and date of actual payment. Okay, all of those things for the contribution. Now, here's the problem. This estate, for two straight years, had claimed deductions in the year in which they were paid. We're not told why they didn't elect to go earlier. We're just told they failed to elect to go a year earlier. Now they want to do so. The IRS allowed in this case the estate to push the deduction back into that prior year, even though it wasn't timely elected. The key issue is the election date is controlled by Regulation 1.642C-1B. It's a regulation set date. The IRS can grant late election relief for late statutory, or for should say late regulatory elections under Regulation 301-9100-1C. You apply for a private letter ruling unless your late election meets one of the requirements under 301.9100-2, which allows for automatic relief. And obviously, the nice thing about automatic relief is no waiting for the letter ruling, and probably more importantly to a lot of people, no paying for the letter ruling that you have to get. In this case, you had to pay for it. But in this case, the IRS, even though they didn't tell us the reason why the estate had elected late, in fact, it wasn't even mentioned, it's virtually as if it's irrelevant, granted them the right to make the late election. They gave them 120 days from the day of the letter to basically amend the prior returns and make the election. key thing to take away from this case or from this particular private letter ruling is remember the IRS, remember the right to throw that deduction back to the prior year in a trust or estate. You have to show it was properly paid out of gross income. Remember, gross income is not necessarily trust accounting income. Take a look. Those are two very different concepts. It has to come out of gross income, but you have to show the authority existed, that there was specific grant of authority to make this contribution. But if you do that, you have your choice of years in which to claim the deduction. So make sure you don't forget that and you consider that with your trust or estate. The final case this week we're going to take a look at is the estate of Powell versus Commissioner, 148 TC number 18, issued on May the 18th. This is a really, really bad fax family limited partnership and charitable lead annuity trust estate planning case. Why is it such a bad fax case? Well, this is really a deathbed plan. We have transfers going first to a family limited partnership and then a donation of the limited partnership interest of the family limited partnership held by the decedent to a charitable lead annuity trust. All of this takes place 1 week before the taxpayer dies. And to make it even worse, the taxpayer was incapacitated and was basically terminal. There was no question she was going to pass away very quickly. Her son, acting under the power of attorney, implemented both forming the family limited partnership and making the gift to the CLAT. Question. Is this going to work? Most of us probably aren't surprised that this type of deathbed planning is going to, you know, have an uphill climb. It's not impossible to make a deathbed plan work, but it's a lot tougher to make one stand up to scrutiny. The first thing the court looked at was, okay, we have these two separate things. Now, by the way, by doing these two transactions, both the family partnership and then the transfer to the CLAT, we reduced $10 million worth of assets down to $1.661 million worth of gifted items on the 709. So that's kind of nice, right? The 709 only shows $1,661,422. Major league reduction, almost an 85% discount. Well, is that going to work? Obviously, it reduced our estate tax pretty dramatically by the time we were done. Well, the first problem we ran into was this CLAT. Okay, remember, first it went to the flip, so everything went to family limited partnership. Nancy got, general partnership interest went to, actually the son was a general partner, and then she got a 99% limited partnership interest. That limited partnership interest then was transferred to the CLAT. Okay, let's leave the flip in place for a second. Let's take a look at the CLAT, the Charitable Lead Annuity Trust. The IRS said, the tax court said, well, here's the problem. You acted under a power of attorney. Well, that power of attorney specifically limited your rights to make gifts to only gifts equal to the annual exclusion amount, $14,000. You transferred about $10 million or whatever, even $1.6 million. Whatever you transferred, it was way over $14,000. The power of attorney gave you no authority to make that transfer. Therefore, the court concluded that transfer under California law was void, was either void at the start or was voidable. Had anyone objected? Now, the taxpayer, basically the son said, okay, I see that, but see, I also had the general power to manage assets under the power of attorney. So I didn't use the gifting provision. I used the general transfer provision. The court took a look at California case law in this area and said, you know what? If there's a specific provision limiting your gifting, that general management of assets clause is considered limited by the limit on gifting. So sorry, this thing doesn't work. Then we go back to the flip. So we've already lost one chunk of discounts. Can we get a discount because Nancy was holding, we're assuming it's voided now, limited partnership interest in a flip that normally would get you a discount. But the court said no, 2036A2. It actually went to A2, not A1. A2, A1's most often been used. That's where there's an implied life estate. There's an implied agreement that Nancy could manage. And the IRS argued that that was true for Nancy as well. But A2, which is the second part of this, if she retained the right in conjunction with her sons to dissolve the partnership and control who would enjoy the property. That's 2036A2. About the only time the tax court has ever mentioned that was in the litany of reasons why the Strangi family limited partnership didn't work back in that case. If you remember from the Strangi case, that's when the Fifth Circuit gave them back to the court to decide 2036 issues, and just Judge Cohen gave it back to the Fifth Circuit with a long laundry list of violations of 2036, huge laundry list of violations of A1, and then finally under A2. A2 is a problem for almost any transfer that's not a bona fide sale if it actually, you know, if we don't have some way of blocking it, which we thought we had with the Byram case. The Byram case says, well, yeah, she obviously has the right to dissolve it with her sons. And remember, dissolve it acting with yourself and any other person. But Byram held for the fact that, and this is how most people interpreted Byram, said, well, yeah, but she has a fiduciary duty to the other partners. And therefore, that fiduciary duty means she does not have an unrestricted right to dissolve the partnership just on a whim. Now, Judge Cohen said in Strangi, if there are no adverse interests, they're saying in Byram, there was an adverse interest. There was a charity and there were non-family members that were also involved in that corporation. They said, if there's no adverse interest, then Judge Cohen said, then there really is no limitation based on fiduciary duty that the duty actually of the son, in this case, the court said, was to mom. And because of that, they're saying, therefore, the right to dissolve existed. The court actually went after A2. Now, before we go too far down getting worried that that indicates the court and the IRS is going there, it's important to note that the estate never really tried to defend against the A2 attack for whatever reason. They didn't mention Byram or anything else. They just simply said, well, see, because of the CLAT, we didn't own it. You know, mom didn't own it on the day she died. Obviously, by the way, they said there's another problem with mom didn't own it. Remember that whole 3 years, you know, gifts within 3 years worth of death? We have to bring the value back in the estate and bring the gift tax back in the estate. And if you do that, since it was only a week, we didn't actually have a whole lot of appreciation that would miss mom's estate doing that transaction either. So there were lots of problems and lots of issues with this. Okay. Finally, they did. The court went and discussed how you determine what to include. And this caused problems with certain members of the tax court. And that's why we have concurring opinions in this case. They said, well, you don't really bring all the assets back in. You rather bring the assets to the extent they're worth more than the partnership interest that was received. So you actually have these two pieces. Now, the dissenting judges say, you know, the judges that did, I think, did it because it's seems to make it more theoretically correct what you're doing. But the court said, we never worried about this before. We just brought the assets in. We just got rid of it as a non-partnership. And they said, the problem is when you're doing this, it appears that it might open up the doors for some interesting planning. If we can somehow leverage what's different between bringing the assets back in versus merely bringing in the excess value that was transferred by the taxpayer if 2036 comes in. Now, again, that's kind of interesting. Obviously, the dissenting judges warned about it. But, you know, don't be surprised to see some people start arguing that even if we lose 2036 otherwise, we'll at least get some sort of amounts pulled out of the estate based on this 2043 inclusion system rather than pulling it all back in. So interesting case from that side. Hey, remember, it's sign-up time for live CPE. By the way, those of you in Arizona, which is where I'm at, please remember that May 31st is coming. And in fact, this week, and hopefully you're listening to this before May 31st, because you got about 2 days, you know, this will be posted by the Society, Arizona Society on Monday, actually probably Tuesday. So hopefully you're listening to it early in the week. You got till the 31st to get your discounts. Everybody else in the country, it is time to just go look at that as well. You know, plan out your CPE year. We're going to be giving the live courses. And definitely, if you want live CPE, you want to have the broadcast live. Some states are doing that now. Be sure you go out and sign up for those. It really helps everybody if we can plan for this and know who's going to be there early on. Also helps with demand and making sure that you actually get the courses that you want. in your states and be able to talk with people live in the course. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of May the 29th, 2017, brought to you by the Lascalzo Institute. You can catch our updates during the week online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also download a PDF with all of this week's articles contained in it discussing what happened. You can send any questions or comments about this week's program to me, Ed Zollers, at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. And you can also follow me on Twitter. My handle there is at Ed Zollers. It's been interesting, and as I said, a week where not a lot happened. We'll see what happens in the short week coming up for taxes. But whatever happens, we'll be back here next week and talking to you about the developments in the area of federal taxes.